Okay. Why changing the world means taking power. So, in shanty towns on the fringes of rich cities like Los Angeles and New York, in the lengthening dole queues in every industrialised country in the world, and in the strikes and street protests in France and Greece, the same angry sentiments echo. Anger at the loss of millions of jobs across the globe and at the profound social injustice of governments bailing out the rich while workers suffer. But it isn't only anger at injustice that has driven people to action. There's also, I think, a really palpable sense that things must change. And most people, whether or not they're involved in struggle, I think can articulate some kind of vision about what changes they'd like to see. So it's pretty common that this vision is of a more democratic world, free of war and oppression, one where people have enough material resources to live decent lives. And I think it can sometimes seem like the question of how we get there is secondary to all of this, that if enough people can just share their vision and work things out as they go, then surely we'll have to see some sort of change for the better. But this is not the way the world works. And the question of how we can change things, of how we can actually achieve a society that is genuinely democratic and free of oppression, this is actually a question that's of critical importance. And as the struggles propelled by this latest global crisis begin to take off, the question of what kind of action we need to take to change the world, this question will also become more and more important. And in the movements and struggles that have already shaped the 21st century, particularly the global anti-capitalist protests, the anti-war protests, and the revolutionary upheavals in Latin America, there have been sharp debates that have broken out about what kind of world we should fight for and how that fight should be waged. And I think at the very core of these debates is the question of whether the Marxist project, that of uniting with the mass of workers and the oppressed to struggle against capitalism, overthrow the existing capitalist state and build a new society based on the democratic organisation and control of the working class, the question of whether that is even possible or desirable is something that I think is being argued out. And those who argue that such a project isn't possible or desirable, they come from a range of political backgrounds and include many prominent anti-war figures, anti-capitalist figures, and writers and journalists such as Susan George and Naomi Klein, and even politicians such as Hugo Chavez. And what these people have in common is their attitude towards the state and the question of power. Because they argue in a range of ways that it's possible to radically reform the existing capitalist state or to try to ignore it and to construct some other lifestyle or version of reality in order to create meaningful change in people's lives. Now, John Holloway, a name I'm sure many of you are familiar with, he's an academic based in Mexico who draws on the ideas of Italian autonomist Antonio Negri, is influenced by postmodernists such as Foucault, and who is primarily inspired by the Zapatistas. Holloway is probably the most prominent contemporary exponent of the argument that such a project is not possible and that the oppressed must find methods of resistance that do not challenge the system as a whole. And in his book, Change the World Without Taking Power, The Meaning of Revolution Today, Holloway argues that the best revolutionary strategy is to find small spaces within capitalism where resistance can take hold and to concentrate on imagining or willing that resistance forward. And in Holloway's view, social movements should operate a little bit like lichen, establish themselves in the cracks and crannies, what he calls the interstices of capitalism's concrete monolith, and merely hope to survive. And the notion that it's possible to take a jackhammer to the concrete, to demolish it entirely in order to make room for the growth of a whole new ecosystem, well, that's just crackpot idealism, according to Holloway. He says, it's more and more clear that capitalism is a catastrophe for humanity and a radical change in the organisation of society, that is, revolution, is more urgent than ever. And this revolution can only be world revolution if it's to be effective. But he goes on to say it's unlikely that world revolution can be achieved in one single blow. And this means that the only way in which we can conceive of revolution is as an interstitial revolution, as a revolution that takes place in the interstices of capitalism, a revolution that occupies spaces in the world while capitalism still exists. Now, Holloway's arguments against revolutionary Marxism, despite being painfully abstract, difficult to read, repetitive, tedious, and full of jargon, in the words of one US socialist, Paul D'Amato, and I agree with him, Holloway's arguments do encompass some of the common points of debates around this question of taking power, and so I will be looking at them a little bit more later. But I'll be arguing today that the ideas of Holloway and his contemporaries leave us with nothing useful in our understanding of how we can change the world, and that far from being another version of revolutionary politics, they are in fact a form of utopian, radical-sounding reformism that is ultimately defeatist. Now, James Petras and Henry Weltmeyer, who are left-wing academics who describe themselves as revolutionaries and anti-imperialists, and they've written extensively on the development of the Latin American social movements, they say quite categorically that the ideas of intellectuals such as Negri and Holloway are totally irrelevant, unable to explain or inform the politics of widespread resistance to capitalist development and imperialism. And for Petras and Weltmeyer, just as for socialists, the struggle for state power, the potential to directly challenge capital rather than to retreat to the interstices, is a central question for workers and the oppressed, and one that just can't be wheeled out of the picture because it seems difficult or even because it might seem impossible at any given historical moment. Changing the world means addressing this question of political power, who holds it and how it's maintained. And in every corner of today's world, that power is concentrated in the capitalist state. From Iraq to Venezuela to Australia, the function of the modern state remains essentially the same as first explained by Lenin, who said that the state is an organ of class rule, an organ for the oppression of one class by another. It is the creation of order which legalises and perpetuates this oppression. And I think we need look no further than today's newspaper to see this theory in action. You can see billion-dollar handouts from governments to executives, the continuation of the slaughter in Iraq and Afghanistan. And these are all legal, state-sanctioned activities that continue to ensure that the richest and most powerful people in the world stay that way. Now, of course, Marxists argue that workers and the oppressed should claw back any reforms that they possibly can in all of this, whether that means demanding mortgage relief rather than handouts to the rich, or calling for an end to imperialist war. But we also argue that capitalism is fundamentally irredeemable, and that to achieve lasting change, real justice and genuine democracy, we need to build struggles that are powerful enough to break the existing forms of state power and to institute radically different and radically democratic forms of state power, of workers' power. And not only do we think this should happen, we know that it can. We know that the capacity of workers to push the class antagonisms of capitalism to the point of direct conflict over this question of power had been demonstrated over and over again, from Russia in 1917 through to Poland in 1980, with the creation of workers' councils, new forms of political power capable of running society for human need and not for profit, and of democratically coordinating the struggle against the existing state. Now, contrast this with the ideas of those who don't see power, the question of state power, as essential in their understanding of the world and what needs to be done to change it. Perhaps we can change the world without taking power. Perhaps we cannot, says Holloway. And tellingly, he admits, I don't know the answer. This hasn't stopped him, however, from writing a book and parading around the world, vocally asserting that we can't. But Holloway sees capitalism as an economic system where each human being's class position and entire life, not as an economic system where each human being's class position and entire life is determined by his or her relationship to production, i.e. whether they own any of the means to produce wealth or whether they're forced to labour to survive. Rather, Holloway sees it as a system of command, where capitalists through money command us, telling us what to do. And he says, to refuse to obey is to break the command of capital. And the question then is, how do we multiply and expand these refusals, these cracks in the texture of domination? He goes on to say that the principal point of reference is not the state, but the society that we want to create. And so you can see, once again, highlighting the vision, but fudging the question of how we're actually going to get there. And Holloway's lack of understanding about the nature of power is common to many of the political currents that just reject the idea that workers can abolish the capitalist state and take power themselves. And I think it's easy to see how with this worldview, power itself becomes the problem. And capitalists are able to command because they hold power, and we can refuse this power, supposedly, and create cracks in the texture of domination. But I think there's quite a number of problems with this idea. And the first problem is that power isn't some abstract evil force. It's concentrated in the hands of the capitalist class. And the second is that we can't crack the domination of capital simply by refusing the command of capitalists. And because most people's daily experience is that they have to work to get money, to live. that they do, to a large extent, live under the command of their boss and the law and society's unwritten rules, which none of which the rich need to bother adhering to. And in all kinds of small ways, people try to make their lives seem more their own, whether that's surfing the web during work or even more political things like joining a union or going to a political demonstration. But I think we shouldn't fool ourselves that any of this is breaking the command of capital. Most of the time, most people don't feel like they have any power at all. And so the idea that acts of refusal, or even many acts of refusal, are going to be enough to crack the system, I think this sort of idea isn't likely to inspire very much hope. And thinking about power in this abstract way also means rejecting any strategy that can actually shape the power of the capitalist class, by ignoring the force that wields enough power to really crack the system's facade. So the struggle against capitalism becomes not some cataclysmic revolutionary event, or even the struggle of workers against bosses, but a constant creation of anti-power inside capitalism and inside ourselves. And revolution is not just becomes not an event centred on the mass struggles of workers, but a series of acts of refusal in which we construct, in the interstices of capitalism, new human beings and new human relationships. And I think such a project is not revolutionary or even really possible. It's just a repackaged version of the utopian lifestyle experiments that Marx rejected in the 19th century. Because rejecting or ignoring the question of state power when talking about changing the world or talking about imagining the society we want to create is a little bit like rejecting or ignoring the need for an engine when you're buying a new car. Whether we like it or not, changing the world means coming to grips with the reality of what kind of forces actually exist in the world today. And whether we like it or not, the state won't leave us alone, because capitalism itself, the system that different states sustain, won't leave us alone. We can't ignore the state because it's the most single, concentrated form of capitalist power. So strategically, we have to be against the state, to pursue revolution against the state, and to be clear on these ideas. And I think importantly, that means looking towards the sort of struggles that have the capacity to challenge and break the existing state and to create new forms of democratic power. And it doesn't mean, came up in the last session as well, doesn't mean seizing the existing capitalist state, which inevitably leads even radical movements to appeasement with the system and turns their leaders into administrators for capitalism. And to see the consequences of this, I think we just have to look at South Africa, where many black workers live in even worse poverty than during the apartheid years, despite the fact that the ANC has been in power since 94. Or we could look at Brazil, where Workers' Party President Lula presides over a growing gap between rich and poor as he continues the neoliberal policies of his predecessors. And I think it's also worth pointing out that Lula staked out a role for Brazil as a sub-imperial power by sending more than 1,000 Brazilian troops to take part in the brutal occupation of Haiti. And the examples of South Africa and Brazil, I think, demonstrate that the Marxist project of smashing the capitalist state and fighting for workers' power and the alternatives of seeking to ignore or radically reform the state, these are not just different paths to the same goal. You actually end up with a different idea of what's possible if you refuse to acknowledge that workers' power is absolutely central. And Rosa Luxemburg expressed this most clearly more than a century ago in her debate with Bernstein about whether capitalism could overcome its inherent contradictions and be reformed. And she wrote, "People who pronounce themselves in favour of the method of legislative reform in place and in contradistinction to the conquest of political power and social revolution do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer and slower road to the same goal, but instead a different goal. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for surface modifications of the old society. And our programme becomes not the realisation of socialism, but the reform of capitalism, not the suppression of the wage labour system, but the diminution of exploitation, that is, the suppression of the abuses of capitalism instead of suppression of capitalism itself." And I think, as we've seen throughout history, it's not possible to permanently suppress the abuses of capitalism without dealing with the question of the system as a whole. And nor is it possible to think about dealing with the system as a whole without looking to the only force that can, the working class. And so it's not surprising either that those who reject the notion that we need to take power and that we need to confront the capitalist state, I think, always end up rejecting Marx's assertion that only workers can fundamentally change the world. Because rejecting the centrality of the working class is extremely important if you think that all forms of power are inherently evil. Because obviously I think the working class, and most people realise this at some level, the working class is the most powerful force in the world aside from the capitalist class. But workers are clearly oppressed, and their power can't just be demonised in the same way that the ruling class's power can. It has to be somehow incorporated into every half-baked worldview that purports to be about some kind of social change. And for those leery of power in all its forms, the best way to deal with this pesky question of workers is to redefine the classical Marxist definition of who is a worker and what constitutes class struggle, to basically water down these definitions until they become largely meaningless. So those who fall under the very broad label of autonomous often redefine class struggle not in orthodox terms of the liberation of work from the domination of capital, but rather the refusal of work. And this leads towards positive forms of struggle involving the creation of alternatives to capitalism based on what Negri called self-valorisation, i.e. the autonomous elaboration of new ways of being, which again is a phrase that I'm sure we're all quite familiar with. Or in other words, utopian experiments that elaborate alternative social relationships that actually mean that workers transcend their status as workers rather than reinforce their class consciousness. And the definition of who is a worker is also redefined in a slightly different way by Holloway, who asserts that nearly everybody is part of the working class because nearly everybody experiences alienation living under capitalism. And so for Holloway, the class struggle just becomes the unceasing daily antagonism between alienation and disalienation. And these different views of the world see human beings as individuals who are trapped like flies in a web of unequal social relationships, unable to change the world because attempts by workers to challenge state power have supposedly always ended in recreating the power relationships that the revolutionary movements were meant to abolish. And I think this just completely confuses power relations and class relations, and it makes a mistake of seeing any and every attempt to exercise power as inevitably reproducing oppression. Because society is not made up of trapped flies, but of workers who are simultaneously trapped by the social relations under capitalism, but also driven by those conditions to collective struggle to transform society. And so the antagonism between workers and capital is not some abstract question of power, it's a concrete question posed every single day. Which side is in control? And the sweep of 20th century history shows us that far from recreating power relations, that mirror the old society, successive revolutionary workers' movements from Russia and Germany in the first half of the century to Iran and Poland in the second, they were tragically defeated by the capitalist class who fought to re-establish their brutal rule. Now, I think the other aspect of rejecting the working class is central in the struggle to change the world. I think generally this kind of idea leads to the promotion of some other oppressed group as a key figure or the key agents for change. And this can be a range of things depending on who you look at. It can be students, peasants, indigenous people, the Cocoleros of Bolivia, the Picoteros of Argentina, or in Holloway's case, the Zapatistas. And I think often some of these people are workers or unemployed workers anyway, and that's important to point out. But their identity as workers is always seen as secondary to their sociological or cultural category. And new imaginative forms of struggle that these groups supposedly initiate are often latched onto and rhapsodised about, even when there's nothing particularly new about them. As all the oppressed groups I've just mentioned have demonstrated, the courageous, passionate struggle for self-determination and liberation by those who suffer under capitalism is absolutely important. And the initiative that these groups provide in fighting for their rights is invaluable. And I just wanted to use, I think, a quote by the Irish socialist James Connolly, who really spells this out when he talks about the relationship between the working class and other oppressed groups. And he says very eloquently, "None so fitted to break the chains as those who wear them, none so well equipped to decide what is a fetter. But whosoever carries the outworks of the citadel of oppression, the working class alone can raise it to the ground." And I think this means that the individual struggles of oppressed groups cannot and should not be separated out from the broader class battles that are taking place today, particularly in Latin America, because it is the working class that actually can provide the social power in the struggles of all oppressed peoples. And what the concepts about the redefinition of the working class actually do in practical terms is strip power from all and every oppressed group by rejecting or ignoring the force that provides the only real unifying basis for fighting against all forms of oppression. Of course, the other element to any rejection of the working class is a rejection of the need for workers to have their own revolutionary party, made up of the most advanced, politically conscious and revolutionary part of the working class and committed to advancing at all times the struggle for workers' revolution. For Holloway, such an idea is simply about hierarchies. He argues that a revolutionary party reproduces the existing hierarchies of the states, and he looks to the sort of monolithic Stalinist parties as his model. And others reject the idea of a party in favour of looking toward the spontaneous struggles of the oppressed, as if that alone can challenge the might of capitalism. But I think we want to be clear that it's precisely the spontaneous nature of struggles that means that we need a revolutionary party. Because for whole periods in history, it can seem like nothing much is happening, that people are very much trapped in their daily lives. And then overnight, huge fissures can open up when people do start to fight back, driven by the ravages of the system into collective action. And I think always these events are characterised by upheaval, by chaos, by new ideas, and uneven consciousness among workers as people grapple with the new situations that they find themselves in. And a revolutionary party that is politically clear and is committed to the different strands of struggles, whether, you know, whenever and however they happen, can prepare the working class and other oppressed groups and social forces allied to it for a struggle for power. And the simultaneously hopeful and grim lesson of history is that such struggles will happen again and again, no matter what kind of esoteric ideas are swirling around in people's heads, because the contradictions at the heart of capitalism, those material contradictions, will never just disappear. And I suppose the grim part of that is that without a revolutionary party that is clear on the need for workers to take power, the ruling class can defeat such struggles, as we've seen over and over again. And so those who ignore or reject questions of power and the state are incapable of providing any clarity or solutions on the key political issues today, such as Palestine or Iraq or any of the Latin American struggles. Some, like Holloway, claim that they're for revolution and that they're operating in the traditions of Marxism with a few little nips and tucks here and there. But the rejection of workers taking power means rejection of virtually every tenet of Marxism, from the materialist conception of history to the centrality of the working class in the struggle for socialism and the very desirability or even possibility of revolution. So when Holloway and others rail against power, they're in fact making an argument against the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. Because if the working class refuses state power, if they refuse to use the organised coercion that they're capable of to wrest control of society from the ruling class, then they basically refuse revolution and accept defeat. And I think we need to see that the capitalist class will not limit themselves in this way, as history has shown. They will fight to hold on to the power that they have. So understanding that that changing the world does mean taking power, that the question of how we get to that vision of a better world that we can all imagine, this question is critically important right now. I think these things are absolutely central for socialists. Because the limits of the struggles for justice and social change within the existing capitalist state is an ongoing question today, right here and now, across Latin America, in Bolivia, Brazil, Venezuela, Ecuador and Paraguay. So far, the leaders of each of these countries, and they're just a few, have been able to balance limited but popular reforms and aids for the poor with their main goal of placating their national capitalist class, all under the guise of socialist rhetoric. And as I said, there are countless examples of this, but I think in Ecuador, for example, the president, Rafael Correa, who came to power in 2007 on the back of the mass movements and indigenous struggles against free market policies and trade deals, has declared a moratorium on the repayment of foreign debt, and much of it, this was accumulated due to IMF restructuring. So obviously this is a massively popular step. Yet Correa has also cracked down using really brutal military force on anti-mining protests waged against the environmental destruction of multinational mining companies. And at the same time, simultaneously, we're seeing a revival of labour struggles, and the labour movement, you know, is really starting to demand that Correa deliver or begin to deliver on the sense of hope and social change that put him in power in the first place. And I think this kind of dynamic, you know, of struggle on the one hand, of leaders with left-wing rhetoric and a certain amount of, you know, limited reform for the poor and the working class. This is a dynamic that can be seen right throughout Latin America. And the fragile equilibrium that we see in societies like Venezuela, like Bolivia, I think no one really knows how long this can last. But the question of who has power and how they exercise that power, you know, these are going to be absolutely key in the coming years. And the stakes for ordinary people right now, today in the world, are higher than ever. The economic crisis, product of an ageing system, has in many countries seen the largest single transfers of wealth to the rich ever. According to Oxfam, in January this year, the total global amount that banks and other financial service firms had already received or been promised was over $8 trillion. So it's not surprising that we've already started to see waves of mass protests and strikes in Europe. It's never been clearer, I think, than today that the capitalist system is a system that just can't provide for the basic needs of most of humanity. It is a system that absolutely wrecks people's lives with impunity. And it's not enough, I want to argue, to wait until the next wave of struggles pushes the question of power to the forefront of everyone's minds. Because look at the consequences of not taking power. The wars and the social suffering and the daily tragedy we see today are happening because many, many revolutionary movements did not take power, because opportunities have been lost or squandered in the past. And we need urgently to build organisations here in Australia and around the world that are clear on this question. And I want to finish with a quote from Claudio Katz, who was one of the people listed on the readings, which I think really sums up the situation that we face. And he writes that the struggles for power involve the fates of millions of individuals. Successes are rewarded with great victories, while failures are paid for in blood and pain and frustration. And so it will be until our side, made up of workers and the oppressed everywhere, has the force and the commitment to take power and change the world.